Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan.
Footage reveals mile after mile of scorched earth where beautiful homes once existed.
The devastation is complete and just jaw-dropping.
You never know where the fire is going to hopscotch. Hours ago, this house was fine, but it caught fire this morning.
Before I begin today's episode, I want to send lots of love, prayers, and thoughts to people impacted by the California wildfires. I had no idea of the gravity of the situation until I started talking to people I know who live in and around Los Angeles. You know, this is a reminder of how desensitized we are when a tragedy is occurring somewhere else, even if it is within the same country. I live in New York and I wasn't aware as much, or maybe not paying attention. I hope all of us can really reconnect with our inner humanity and feel for people who are suffering within our country and across the globe, whether it's California or Palestine. Let's hope that our shared humanity prevails. And now to today's episode. So brace yourselves for a topic that often evokes extreme reactions from people on both sides of the aisle: religion. I consider myself adequately religious with a focus on the humanist side of my faith, the egalitarian principles of Islam, the emphasis on compassion, and the soft skills that connect us as humans. I also firmly believe that my faith is my journey, and it's not my job to play moral police for others. Talking about others, religion holds an intriguing place in American society. While a significant number of people identify as non-religious, Christianity still dominates the cultural and societal framework. Some might even argue there is a persistent push to intertwine religion with governmental spheres. But what does it mean to be a religious minority in America? And how do Christian religious leaders perceive other faiths or the absence of faith altogether? How do they promote inclusivity and equality in a diverse society? To help me unpack these questions and more, I am thrilled to welcome our guest, Minister Lydia Sohn. Lydia is a religious minister and a writer whose work intersects faith, identity, and the human condition. She's known for her thoughtful, nuanced perspectives that challenge conventional ideas about faith and spirituality. Let's dive in. Thank you for joining me on Immigrantly. Lydia, you're based in California, right?
Yes, in the easternmost edge of Los Angeles County, in a little town called Claremont.
How are you impacted by the wildfires?
Several of our friends lost their homes because Altadena is just 30 miles away. And we definitely got the debris and the smoke from the fires, but fortunately, our neighborhood and our surrounding neighborhoods were unaffected. And so we've all just been praying for a quick recovery and for all the first responders helping out right now.
I wonder, as a religious leader, how do you grapple with situations like these, tragedies that occur? How do you reconcile with them?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And it's an age-old question of, if there is a God that's a loving, divine being who cares for all of us, and why is there so much tragedy and suffering in the world? And definitely a question that I've grappled with for so many years, beginning in high school. And for me, and as a progressive Christian, we honor people of all faith traditions. So I'm not of the faith tradition that this way is the only way. But for my specific tradition, and that's the one that I speak out of and minister to, that community, we identify Jesus as Emmanuel, and that's his name that we remember during Christmas time, which is God with us. And so for me, how I've come to make peace and understand God during the most difficult of times, and the miracle of Christmas, is that all of our suffering in this world doesn't disappear, all of our heartbreak. And actually, if it did, life would be so boring for all of us if we were just happy, go lucky all the time, right? But the crux of what I believe is that our suffering doesn't go away, but that we're never alone in our suffering, that God is close to the brokenhearted, that God walks with us, that we are never alone. Emmanuel meaning God with us. And God with us is not only God actually within us and alongside us and holding us and holding our hand, but also with us through our community. And so it's during these times of tragedy when I see so much love erupt in our communities. Our friends have opened their homes to everybody who lost their homes, and they're now seeking refuge in their home. They're having like big dinners together. You know, all of our church communities are getting together to fundraise for those beloved belongings that were burned in the fires. And I feel like in times of suffering and tragedy, so much care and love come to the surface even more so. And so that's also how I see God so active in our lives, that God comes alive even more through all of us.
I understand where you're coming from, but at the same time, playing devil's advocate here, people who are going through the pain and the tragedy, for them, it's very difficult to reconcile with this idea of, you know, pain is part of living.
Yeah.
Because they are suffering through that in real time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's one. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But I'm also curious to know, when you talk about community, in a country like the US that's so individualistic, the idea of community and how people give and share is a bit difficult to grapple with at times, right? Although in times of tragedy, I know people are more giving, but then people go back to living their lives and they don't think about how their actions can have a consequence of how people suffer in the end. So with wildfires, climate change is a big thing, right? We talk about climate catastrophe. People who are suffering through it, or people who have opened their homes, I wonder if they can make those connections, and how do we make sure that we don't let this happen again?
It's all so related. Yes. No, I understand what you're trying to say. And you're right. The US is very individualistic, much more individualistic than more collective cultures all around the world. And that's actually what I explore in my book too, here, A Spirituality of Staying in a Culture of Leaving. Right, coming from an immigrant background where, ironically, even though Korean culture is very communal, my parents came to America in search of the American dream. So they were always on the move, leaving one community to the next in order to climb the socioeconomic ladder and pursue the American dream. And they did achieve the American dream. But what they lost was the community, because we were always moving. And that was a loss that I felt very distinctly as a grown-up when my fiance and I were deciding where to get married. And he had lived in the same house ever since he was a first grader, whereas my parents had moved like every 4 to 5 years. I am seeking a countercultural way of living that's against what I was shown growing up, you know, of like being committed to our community, even when our society teaches us to leave and go anywhere you need to go in order to achieve your dreams.
Was choosing this path of being a religious leader a consequence of seeking community?
Well, definitely growing up, even though my parents were always on the move, we were always a part of a Korean American church community. So that provided a little nest of safety wherever I was and every new city that we lived in. And so, yes, my love of community derives from feeling so loved in my Christian communities growing up. And also, I have just always been the personality and the type to like ask these very like big mystical questions, as I'm sure I can tell you do as well. Like when all of my friends would be so bored at church or during Bible studies, I just like had this insatiable hunger to learn more about God and the universe and these like bigger questions. So it makes sense in college, I, you know, went on to pursue religious studies and philosophy and then went on to seminary because it was just my personality and my drive.
PSA for anyone who rents. If you haven't heard of Built, you are about to thank me. Earning points on rent is now a reality when you pay your rent through Built. You don't even have to check with your landlord to start earning points that you can use toward flights, hotel stays, fitness classes, and even your next rent payment. Let me break it down for you. There's no cost to join Built, and as a member, you'll earn valuable points on rent and on your everyday spending. Built points can be transferred to your favorite hotels and airlines, and even the ones you haven't heard of. There are over 500 airlines and 700,000 hotels and properties around the world you can redeem your Built points toward. Points can also be redeemed towards a future rent payment and unique experiences that only Built members can access. How incredible is that? So, if you're not earning points on rent, my question is, why not? Start earning points on rent you're already paying by going to joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. That's joinbuilt.com/immigrantly. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you. joinbuilt.com/immigrantly to start earning points on your rent payments today. Religion inherently means putting faith in something that you cannot fully explain or understand, right?
Yeah, the mystery.
How did you reconcile with the side of you seeking answers versus the side of you that just wanted to surrender to the unknown?
Well, it's both. So there's a great passage where a lawyer, so a very intelligent person, comes to Jesus and asks him, how do I inherit eternal life? And Jesus quotes the Hebrew Bible, the commandment to love God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. And I love that because in some faith communities, they discourage the use of the mind, like don't ask too many questions, don't doubt. Those are all signs of a weak faith. But Jesus explicitly says, and the Hebrew Bible also explicitly shows us, that our minds are a gift from God to use, to question, to learn more, to doubt, to critique. But our mind has its limits as well, because humans don't know the answers to the universe, you know? And so that's when our souls come in and embrace of the mystery and our faith and a connection with God that's deeply contemplative and based on trust. And so I like to utilize all parts of ourselves in order to strengthen that spirituality.
Can you share what is one question that you're grappling with in this moment?
Oh my gosh. Yes. So I'm thinking right now of certain philosophers who say that their life is all about pursuing big questions, but day to day, we ask questions that are very particular to our own lives that seem very petty, but that's actually how all of us are. And so every day I ask questions about my life, like, should we move homes? And that's like a question that I'm constantly grappling with and bringing before God and asking God to help me, knowing that no struggle in our life is too big for God or too petty for God to consider and help us with.
As someone navigating this intersection of being a woman, a person of color, and a religious leader, how do these identities shape your ministry, Lydia, especially coming from an immigrant background?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's such a big question. Well, I think as an immigrant who was always a minority in a lot of my communities growing up, I have a special connection with a part of Jesus's message and the message of the Bible that God cares for those who are on the outskirts of community. Having felt that myself and having seen that experience for my parents and people of color, I say this with a caveat, knowing that even though I'm an immigrant and a person of color, and that has rendered specific experiences of exclusion and trying to belong, I'm married to a white man from New Jersey whose family has been in the country for many generations, that he has also had experiences of exclusion too. So I think everyone has their own experiences of hardship and exclusion.
Yeah, but it's different.
It's so different, right? No, it's so different.
Being part of a dominant population or a dominant faith in a country renders itself to a lot of privileges.
Yeah.
I can speak to that because when I was in Pakistan growing up there, I was part of the dominant population and dominant religion. And having become an immigrant in the US, especially a Muslim immigrant, now when I look back, I can see how other minorities must be feeling in those situations in that society, right? But I do want to go back to something that you said about being on the outskirts and how within religion there is space for people who are minority. Theoretically, you're absolutely right. Every religion preaches that. Practically, people who believe in certain religions don't apply it beyond their own communities. If there is a suffering happening somewhere else in the world, and if people are unable to connect to those humans through some visible physical manifestation of who they are desensitized in most instances. As a minister, what do you tell people who come to your congregation? How do you address those moments of lack of connection with other faiths, other identities?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I'm a part of a progressive Christian denomination that honors people of different faith traditions and different faith journeys. And so we don't teach that there are certain groups that are chosen and not chosen, but rather this is our distinct faith tradition. And we believe that everybody is a beloved child of God. And that makes us a part of one human family where we care for each other, no matter your religious background or where you're from or racial identity or physical abilities or sexual orientation or any of that. But that said, I do agree with you that we do become desensitized to the suffering that's happening in other parts of our world. And even myself, right, I'm a mom of three kids, young kids, you know, under the age of 10. And I have a full-time job, and I'm also a writer, and I still try to maintain a social life and, you know, exercise on occasion and have my hobbies. And so we're kind of at capacity in terms of what we can do a lot of us, especially working parents. But I often revert to the famous quote by Marcus Aurelius, do what is mine to do. What is mine to do? And sometimes I get so overwhelmed by the suffering in the world, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict right now, the wildfires in LA. And there's this need of like, I want to help. I want to do something. What can I do? And sometimes the best thing that we can do, especially for those of us who are already so overcommitted in our lives, is focus on what is mine to do. What has been given to me? My family, my community, my neighborhood, my friends, my parents, right? Like, this is my circle of care for right now. And if everyone just focused on their circle of care, I believe this world would be such a better place.
But then how would we care for those who are suffering?
I think that it just kind of, it's like a ripple effect of like, as we care for our smaller communities, our micro communities, that has this impact that spreads all around us. I think we underestimate the power of acting small and living small, especially because America teaches us to live big and live your biggest life and, you know, have the biggest impact. But actually what I've seen is that ironically, paradoxically, that we have the biggest impact by acting small.
Give me an example.
Okay, so I think climate change is a great example. And of course, we can, you know, write these big corporations and try to write letters that change policy, you know, in terms of the energy that we use and the, you know, the products that we use to make everything in this world. But what I see is communities and individuals living more simply, eating less meat, right? Thrifting, buying things that are used and sharing them with each other. And so these are the small decisions that we make every single day that I think can make just as big of an impact as these greater impact actions.
And voting for people who believe in climate change.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, just our lives are the best witness. When our words don't work, like Mother Teresa said, let your words be the last thing that you use. Let people look at your life.
Lydia, you've mentioned your denomination as progressive a few times, and that you create space for people from all different faiths, identities. Give me an example of what does that space look like and what does that interaction look like?
When people come to our church and we pray together, there's a time of prayer at every Sunday service. We lift up our joys and concerns. And when I lead that prayer time, I always say that no matter where you are on your faith journey, God hears you. No matter what you've done or what you believe, God loves you. And so that's kind of like the baseline. We also have these certain sacraments in the Christian church, like communion. And before we offer communion, it's always said, like, you don't need to believe a certain book of tenets or doctrines to receive this gift of bread and wine that symbolize God's love and forgiveness. Like, everybody, if there is a stirring within your soul to receive this because you feel like it's going to bring you closer or so you can have a spiritual moment with God, then please come forward, you know, and partake of this mystery. The language that we use is that everybody is welcome here, no matter where you are on your journey. But in addition to that, I'm a part of different like interfaith alliance groups and communities where whenever there's something going on in our community, the faith leaders of the different traditions, the faith traditions with our neighborhood get together. The leaders get together in order to take action on certain items that need to be taken.
It seems to me that you lead by compassion, right? There's a lot of focus on shared humanity. That's how you see your faith. But Christianity has a complex history, you know?
Yes, it does.
It also grapples with critiques about patriarchy, colonialism, exclusivity. How do you address those critiques in your work while staying true to your faith?
I think that every religious tradition has histories that are difficult because humans are complex beings. where we are wired to protect our own kind. And so whatever we teach or believe, it is never perfect because humans aren't perfect. You know, even families are not perfect. We often make mistakes. We hurt each other, and we have to practice forgiveness and love, reflection on our past behavior. And I don't see our faith tradition as doing anything different.
But do you focus on reconciliation with past behavior? Do you talk about the difficult, inconvenient truths within religion?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that self-reflection, like honest self-reflection, is the only way that we can move forward and be a better version of ourselves. And so I'm very, very clear and explicit about our history of sexism, racism, homophobia, nationalism, right? All of these things that are so that humans took up the language of Christianity in order to forward their agendas and hurt others in the name of Christianity.
Where has self-reflection led you?
Well, every day I'm reflecting. In my book, I talk about how spiritual practices are one of the primary tools that help us to stay committed to our communities and circumstances. Because the natural human impulse is to always escape and see something new or seek something new when anything is difficult, right? That's the natural human impulse. If something gets difficult, conflict in a school, at our work, our marriage, the first thought is, I gotta leave, right? Like, this is just a natural human impulse. And so there are many different tools and stories and guides that I use for helping people stay committed and transform their circumstances from the inside out. But one of those are spiritual practices.
How do you utilize those practices in your personal life?
So one, my favorite one is St. Ignatius's Daily Examen. So the Daily Examen, that's Latin for examining your daily life. And it's very simple. So at the end of each day, as I'm getting ready for bed and all the kids have been put to bed and I have a quiet moment, I close my eyes and I reflect on the day from the beginning to the end. I slowly go forward. It doesn't take more than 5 minutes, right? From like when I get up to when I went to bed. And as I'm reflecting on the day, I'll notice moments or memories that give me a little extra joy or peace that I kind of missed in the moment, because when we get so flustered and busy throughout our days. So it's only when we reflect that we can see, oh my gosh, God was there and God was there and God was there. And there was extra love there and tenderness. This very simple spiritual practice helps us notice where God is moving in our lives, where the Spirit is alive in our lives. And when we can see and recognize it in the retrospect, we actually strengthen our muscles to recognize them in the present moment. So we don't miss them, right? So when I'm on a walk with my son, and normally in the past, I would have thought it was boring, but in a daily examen exercise, I noticed that I felt so much peace. When it's actually happening in real time, I get to be so present to it and recognize, wow, this is such a sacred moment right now, right? And then the energy that I bring to that becomes so much more positive and fulfilling than before because I've done this spiritual practice.
You are a religious leader, which in some ways puts you on a pedestal for people to look up to and seek guidance from. How do you ensure that this position that you're in doesn't lead to arrogance?
Oh, well, I make a lot of mistakes, so that helps keep me humble. Every day I make mistakes. I was like, oh, I was too harsh with somebody, or I made that decision way too quickly, or I didn't prepare that sermon enough. So I'm kind of critical, and so that keeps me very humble. But
give me an example of when you were harsh with somebody.
I have difficulty with people who are overly anxious. That's just one of my weaknesses. It's hard for me to embrace that. the kind of, you know, when we have a budget deficit, like, oh my God, the church is going to die tomorrow. And I have very little tolerance. And so I have to just build that tolerance within me, because what I want to yell is just, you know, calm the F down, right? And like, don't spread your anxiety to everybody else. That's something that I am very aware of and I've been working on. But what helps me be a good spiritual leader and live up to this role that I have received and accepted is, once again, regular spiritual practices. So if I don't feed myself, it's hard for me to feed others. And I also see myself as just the role that I am not the bread of life. I lead you to the table where I believe the bread of life can be found, right? So I have a certain amount of training and a calling, and I will help you, but I am not the Messiah. I'm not the answer. And so this recognition of humility and recognizing that everybody's calling is sacred and holy, whether that's a minister or a stay-at-home mom or a CEO or whatever else you have chosen in your life, right? Because every calling is sacred. So I take a lot of walks in the woods. That helps me stay connected to God and listen out for God and God's guidance for my community. I pray, I study the Bible, I pray in community. You know, these like spiritual practices really help me stay grounded.
How do you surrender as a minister? There are moments where you just surrender to God, because being a person of faith also means believing that there is a bigger power who's controlling a lot of things that are happening in this world, right? And as humans, we find it very difficult to give up control because we feel like we can achieve so much. Do you feel more or less powerful when you do that?
Oh, I totally feel more powerful when I surrender, because I surrender it to somebody with a vision and a power much greater than mine. But you're right in that our temptation is to solve it ourselves, right, as humans, because especially, you know, people like you and me who are pretty high achieving and have done pretty well in our lives and see ourselves as very capable, our temptation is to solve everything, you know, and to save the day with our intellect and resources and problem-solving skills. But I think a great example of this is the church community that I serve, Walnut United Methodist Church. I started that just after the pandemic started. And it was a very confusing time for all of us. Financially, the congregation was struggling badly because, you know, the weekly offering wasn't being met, and our rent contributions from the preschool and other groups that were using our facilities weren't being received. And I had this difficult season of trying to solve their problems. And when I surrendered and I brought all of this before God, the words that I heard were, "This is not your church, it's my church. These are not your children, they're my children. And I've sent you there to help them, but you don't need to solve everything for them, right? You can live alongside them and support them and give them the faith that I will help you." And we got ourselves out of it. You know, but I have to remind myself of this every time that there's a difficult situation.
Lydia, what is the physical manifestation of your conversations with God? Because I'm trying to envision how those conversations take place, right? Explain to me, when you say God telling me this, do you ask for signs?
Yeah. So you're asking a really great question. Essentially, you're just asking about prayer. What does prayer look like?
Yeah, but it seems like the way you're describing it, it's not just you praying to God. It seems like you're interacting,
yeah.
Interacting with God, where you are having a conversation, which is back and forth.
Yes, yes. So that is a big part of prayer, conversations, and then not just talking, but listening.
How do you listen?
So it's definitely a practice that I have had to hone for many years now. But the easiest way to start is, I believe, by journaling. Brené Brown has this great quote, "We move information from our minds to our hearts through our hands." And so whenever I'm grappling with a question, I take a few deep breaths to settle myself and lift up a little prayer. God, I want to hear from you. I need your help. I know you're with me. I know you love me, right? Just like claiming the truth of God loving us so much and wanting to connect with us, that God is not too big for our problems or our lives. And I take a couple of deep breaths to really connect with a deeper part of me, you know, like the gut and the heart, not my mind, because the mind is where all of our anxieties live, our worries. And then I just start scribbling and I ask questions like, what should I do about this situation? And then I scribble back. And then I notice if the scribbling back was filled with peace. And that's a really good sign. If it's a message from somebody beyond yourself, is that it will fill you with this incomprehensible peace.
Why not anxiety?
Because I believe that the nature of God is peace, love, hope, assurance, faith. It's like this feeling that everything is okay and that you're cared for. That's like the crux of God's character. And so that really gets communicated to us when God speaks to us. So you can try it and let me know. I would love to hear. And then as you do this regularly with any problem, like any problem in the world or any problem in your own life, like what should I do about this? Or how am I not seeing this situation clearly? Or what do I need, you know, to move forward on this? And you start writing it out. And eventually you just start talking to God and the words come more freely. So I still journal a lot, but sometimes I'll just hear things like on a walk in the middle of the night, you know, if I'm wrestling with a question, and then I'll wake up in the middle of the night and like have a deep knowing about something. But the fact that you're even asking means that there's the channel that's wanting to be opened between you and God.
You know, you're a writer as well, so I'm pretty sure that a lot of what you do spiritually also really manifests in the way you write. But I do want to go back. For a lot of people who are listening to our episode right now, especially those who are non-religious, I'm sure it's very difficult for them to connect with this conversation, right? In many societies, especially in the US, people are moving away from organized religion.
Yes, yes.
Religion is being replaced by other rituals, whether spiritual or not. What role do you think faith still plays in a contemporary culture? And what would you say to someone listening right now who is non-religious and sees themselves unheard or unseen in this conversation?
Well, I think, let me move from back to front. So your final question and moving to what you said earlier. So I am a spiritual writer. And I do speak from my own experience and write from my own experience as a Christian and as a minister and as an immigrant, as a Korean American immigrant, as a woman, right? And I think as a writer, there's always this longing to want to connect with the most amount of people. And so to kind of drop all of these particularities, hoping that we'll speak to more people. And actually what I have found is the opposite. The more true we are to our own particular experiences, the more specific we are about our context, the more people we speak to, because people are smart enough to translate that to their own experiences, right? Like, so even if they're not Christian, everybody has a hunger for the beyond, for the mystery. A lot of people ask these bigger questions and then they apply it to their own lives, right? Or these spiritual practices that I speak of. Yes, they come from a Christian tradition, but as I've studied other traditions like Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, a lot of those other traditions share the spiritual practices that I'm speaking about, prayer, contemplation.
What about non-religious people?
Yeah, I mean, even like yoga, right? Or like meditation circles. These are all like very new agey things. And they share like a lot of these spiritual practices that millennials or spiritual, not but religious populations, these younger generations are practicing. they map on so easily to this ancient spiritual practices because they come from the ancient spiritual practices. They don't come from nowhere. I feel like it's a gift for writers or ministers or speakers of any kind to speak from their own experiences and not to dilute that, because we think that being specific means that others won't be able to connect with us, but actually it's the opposite, right? Like the more specific we are, the more true we are to our own experiences, the more it speaks to others because they can make that translation on their own of like what in their own lives has spoken to them and what in their own lives they honor. And there's a lot of overlap too. And then going back to what you asked earlier about the newer generations not going to church as much, this is just a conversation that I feel like is happening within the church so much because the church attendance have been on decline. Churches have been closing down. And it's like a lot of anxiety about what we're going to do. Is there going to be a church tomorrow? I don't care. I know that my welfare is tied up with the survival of the church. And going back to like, this is God's words of like, this is my church. This isn't yours. People are always going to follow God no matter what time or generation we're in. It might look different. It's not going to look like the Protestant church that I go to now and that I lead. That's okay. The church looked different 1500 years ago than it does now. And then during the Protestant Reformation, people were freaking out that the church was going to close down. And what it meant was like the birth of another expression of Christianity. And I just feel like we're just going through another transition. And just because it's not going to look the same, it's not a bad thing. You know, I'm just open to what the Spirit does in the future. I will say, though, that what I feel like are crucial for a strong spirituality is the continuing on of the spiritual practices given to us by our ancestors. A study of the ancient spiritual texts, community, right? Because there's something magical that happens when we connect with others and seek God together. And that is something that I have not seen New Age, spiritual but not religious communities take on, that community piece that you've also mentioned, right? We're very individualistic, but it's something like practicing our spirituality in a community that brings a new element of strength to us. So I think that no matter what the church looks like, as long as those factors are carried on, spiritual practices, community, study of our ancient spiritual texts, that God will keep meeting us anew in every generation.
What would it look like if you could envision the future of faith and spirituality in America?
Well, if I were to look in a crystal ball and see the future of the church in America, one, it's going to be a lot smaller than it was during the 1960s in America, during the suburban expansion, when white folks in suburbia just went to church on Sundays because it was a thing to do. That is not the culture that we live in right now. And I don't see that change being a bad thing, because in the 1960s, people went to church not because they wanted to, but because it was a cultural expectation.
Ah, oh, that's a very interesting point.
Right? Like you just went to church on Sunday. And so it was mostly white in America. And so there was probably a lot of like cultural messages that were being promoted that were tied in with Christianity that have nothing to do with Christianity. So I believe that this new era where churches are smaller, more diverse, it consists of people who actually want to be there instead of people who feel like they're pressured to be there because it's the thing to do on Sunday morning. And though we might be smaller in number, I believe that we'll be stronger in faith and spirituality.
And in the end, Lydia, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of its relationship with faith, how would you do that?
I think that the United States of America's history with faith is so, so complicated and ugly and beautiful at the same time. I love that from the founding of the country, and this is not even like addressing our colonial history, right? Of like taking the land from people who are already living here. But I'm just talking about the nation state as we know it today, that our forefathers really came to this country with a hope of freedom, and they wanted to detach our country from Christianity. And it has been a struggle to do so, but we have separation of church and state that many other countries don't have still. And so where people of all religions can live here and practice their religion, hopefully safely, not always, but that's what we believe. Those are our values. We cling to those values and we fight for those values. And it's just a journey of getting to what our forefathers originally intended from the beginning. And we've made a lot of mistakes, lots of mistakes. And it's up to us to make sure to live into the dream of America.
Thank you, Lydia. This was so much fun. You are a writer, and we could have talked so much about your writing, and we didn't, so hopefully next time. But tell us about your book.
Yes. So my book, it's called Here, A Spirituality of Staying in a Culture of Leaving. And it is helping readers to cultivate a spirituality of stability in an age that teaches us we should leave anything behind in order to pursue greener pastures. And I address that as a myth. And this goes for all parts of our lives, from our careers to our relationships, to our communities, our neighborhoods, etc. It's going to be released on February 25th, but you can pre-order in any place that sells books. And this is my debut book, a lot of memoir, a lot of spiritual ideas in it too. So it's weaving both. And I hope that you can, if this sounds interesting to you, I hope that you can read it and that you're touched by it. And I poured so much of myself into it. So I'm so excited to have it be born into the world. And thank you for asking about it.
Thank you, Lydia. This was so much fun. Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you. And I loved your questions.
Thank you. Remember when I said I will try to be more honest this year? This is me being honest. This was a good interview, but a tough one. Because you know what? Talking about religion makes me uncomfortable. Maybe because I practice a religion that's so taboo in this country. It's sometimes difficult for me to acknowledge my religious identity because of the fear of how people will perceive me. I hope this conversation was a good learning experience for all of you. And again, I want to ensure everyone, those who practice different faiths and those who are non-religious, these conversations are for all of us to learn, think, introspect, and take whatever makes us feel comfortable. This episode was produced by me, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. The music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I bring another important conversation for all of you. Take care.